Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for In the News and American Stories, coming up after As It Is.
From VOA Learning English, this is As It Is. I'm Anna Mateo in Washington. On today's show, we talk about technology. From very low-tech to very high-tech. In the second half of our program, we will find out what one U.S. dollar can buy for your science laboratory. That would be the low-tech part of the program. But first, we hear how people can control robotic arms using only their thoughts. Here is June Sims to tell us the story of Mind Over Matter.
Kathy Hutchinson is a tetraplegic. She has not been able to move her arms, legs, or speak since suffering a stroke nearly 15 years ago. Recently, she learned how to control a robotic arm using her thoughts. She now can use brain activity to serve herself a drink. The American woman is one of two people who took part in a research project known as BrainGate 2. The researchers have spent years studying how to help people who are paralyzed regain movement in their arms and legs. John Donahue is a neuroscientist with Brown University and the Department of Veterans Affairs. He also was part of the project.
People who are paralyzed have their brain disconnected from their bodies. So our idea is to bypass that damaged nervous system and go directly from the brain to the outside world. So the brain signals can not control muscles, but control machines or devices like a computer or a robotic limb.
The two paralyzed people had small sensors connected to the part of the brain that controls movement. The devices measured brain activity and sent that information to a computer. The computer has special software that turns the information into digital commands for operating other devices. The researchers used a highly developed robotic arm to recreate human actions. The BrainGate team had its first success in 2006. A tetraplegic stabbing victim was able to use the brain-computer interface system to control a computer cursor. A video of the latest experiment shows Kathy Hutchinson using the robotic arm to pick up a cup of coffee. She guides the cup toward her mouth, moves it forward, and drinks through a straw. The research team carried out almost 200 tests with two different robotic arms. The two individuals were able to pick up their target objects 43% to 66% of the time. The researchers are calling the information very promising, but they say it will take years to fully develop the technology for everyday use. I'm June Sims.
Thanks, June. And I'm Anna Mateo. You are listening to As It Is. Earlier in the show, we talked about the science of computers reading a person's thoughts to move robotic arms. That is very advanced technology, or what we call high tech. But sometimes, scientific discoveries are very low tech. They are simple, but they work. Christopher Cruz tells us about a low-tech invention that costs less than a can of Coca-Cola.
New scientific discoveries often use the latest technology. But a new microscope is just the opposite. The Foldscope is a microscope made from folded paper. It is like origami, the ancient Japanese art of folding paper, except for laboratories. The design of Foldscope is simple. It takes only 10 minutes to put together the paper board. But the microscope is powerful. Its tiny lens can magnify objects up to 2,000 times. And the best part is, it only costs $1. One of the co-designers of Foldscope is a bioengineer at Stanford University. Manu Prakash says Foldscope could help developing countries that have severe problems with diseases such as malaria. He says it is important to know which kind of malaria the patient has, or if she has malaria at all. Microscopes are necessary tools for identifying what is causing a patient to be sick. But in the developing world, microscopes are often broken. Duke University bioengineer Robert Malkin says that the number of broken microscopes is high, and they are costly to replace.
It's pretty amazing, actually. The number of broken microscopes is overwhelming. We work in hundreds and maybe even thousands of hospitals around the world. None of our hospitals can afford to buy a microscope. They're far too expensive.
Enter Foldscope. The most expensive part of Foldscope is the high-power lens, a 56-cent ball of glass. The low-power lens only costs 17 cents. Foldscope does not cost a lot, but it is strong. To prove that point, workers in a laboratory dropped one from a three-story building and stepped on it. It still worked. Robert Malkin says Foldscope is a step in the right direction. But he says there are many other issues to consider before a microscope actually works well in the field. One of those issues is human training. Orly Jandron works to improve the availability of clean water and sanitation at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. She says that a microscope without a trained person behind it is useless. Ms. Jandron adds that Foldscope could be a useful educational tool. She says if people could see the microbes in water that make them sick, it could help change their behavior. Mr. Prakash admits that there is a training gap in developing world healthcare. But he hopes that making medical tools available will be a step forward. I'm Christopher Cruz.
And I'm Anna Mateo. Check us out on Facebook, iTunes, and YouTube. And keep listening for more Learning English programs.
In the News is next, followed by American Stories. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is In the News. This year, 52,000 children have entered the United States from Mexico without a family member or guardian. The children are mainly from Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras. U.S. Border Patrol agents detain most of the boys and girls. Normally, Mexican citizens who are caught are quickly returned to Mexico. People from other countries are processed through the immigration court system. By law, children cannot be sent back alone. They must be processed through the Office of Refugee Resettlement or put under the care of family members living in the United States. Sean Moran is Vice President of the National Border Patrol Council. He describes what U.S. agents have seen recently along the Rio Grande River border with Mexico.
Most times, people that are crossing the border illegally attempt to evade the Border Patrol. They do not seek them out unless they're injured. But in these cases, Border Patrol agents are actively being sought out. People are just waiting in very conspicuous areas to be apprehended by the Border Patrol.
Michael McCall is a member of both the Republican Party and the U.S. House of Representatives. He is the chairman of the House Homeland Security Committee. He says the Obama administration should have predicted the large number of unaccompanied children.
The tragic fact is these children are making a dangerous journey based on misinformation and the false promise of amnesty.
Congressman McCall says areas along the Mexican border, like his home state of Texas, are unable to deal with so many children. He wants President Obama to take action.
States should not need to protect what is in the federal government's role under our Constitution.
The Obama administration rejected putting National Guard troops along the border. Last week, the administration also announced plans to open more detention centers to house the children. Mississippi Congressman Benny Thompson belongs to Mr. Obama's Democratic Party. Mr. Thompson rejected the blame from Republicans.
It is irresponsible to attribute this crisis to one U.S. policy, or for that matter, one U.S. president.
Some Republican lawmakers have called for more fences and tougher security along the border. Republican Congressman Mike Rogers represents Alabama. He says the crisis is avoidable.
I've been there. I know what I'm talking about. And we don't have a fence down there, and if we did, we wouldn't have five-year-old children coming across.
Tristan Reed is a Mexico security expert. He says the drug trade is largely to blame for people leaving Central America.
They are escaping from legitimate drug wars that are going on in their cities or their municipalities.
He says poverty also influences the decision of many parents to send their children to the United States. Jay Thompson is the head of the Department of Homeland Security. He calls the migration of Central American children a humanitarian crisis.
We're talking about large numbers of children without their parents who have arrived at our border hungry, thirsty, exhausted, scared, and vulnerable. How we treat the children in particular is a reflection of our laws and our values.
He adds that the U.S. government is required by law to provide care for the children. And that's In the News from VOA Learning English. I'm Mario Ritter.
Now, the VOA Special English Program, American Stories. We continue the story of The Open Boat by Stephen Crane. As we told you last week, the story is based on true events. In 1896, Crane was traveling to Cuba as a newspaper reporter. On his way there, his ship sank in the Atlantic Ocean. Crane climbed into the last remaining small lifeboat. Three men got into the boat with him. They were the ship's captain, the cook, and a sailor named Billy. For 3 days, the men steered the tiny boat through high waves off the coast of Florida. At last, they saw land. Here is Shep O'Neill with the final part of the story.
A long stretch of coast lay before the eyes of the men. Slowly the land rose up out of the mountainous sea. The men could see a small house against the sky. To the south they could see a lighthouse. Tide, wind, and waves were pushing the lifeboat northward. The men thought someone on land would have seen the boat by now. "Well," said the captain, "I suppose we'll have to attempt to reach the shore ourselves. If we stay out here too long, none of us will have the strength left to swim after the boat sinks." So Billy the sailor turned the boat straight for the shore. "If we don't all get ashore," said the captain, "I suppose you fellows know where to send news of my death." The men then exchanged some information. There was a great deal of anger in them. They thought, "If I am going to be drowned, why in the name of the seven mad gods who rule the sea was I permitted to come this far and think about sand and trees?" The waves grew stronger. They seemed always just about to break and roll over the little boat. The coast was still far away. The sailor said, "Boys, the boat won't live 3 minutes more, and we're too far out to swim. Shall I take her to sea again, Captain?" "Yes, go ahead," said the captain. The sailor turned the boat and took her safely out to sea again. "It's funny those life-saving people haven't seen us," one of the men said. "Maybe they think we're out here for sport. Maybe they think we're fishing. Maybe they think we're fools." Once more the sailor rowed the boat, and then the reporter rowed. Suddenly they saw a man walking along the shore. The man stopped walking. He moved his hand in the air to wave at them. He saw them. Now he was running to the house. The captain tied a cloth to a stick and waved it. Now there was another man on the shore. The two men waved their hands in the air as if they were saying hello to the men in the boat. Now, what was that moving on the shore? It was a bus, a hotel bus. A man stood on the steps of the bus and waved his coat over his head. The man in the boat wondered what he wanted to say. Was he attempting to tell them something? Should they wait for help? Should they go north? Should they go south? The men waited and waited, but nothing happened. The sun began to go down. It got dark and cold. They could no longer see anyone on the beach. The sailor rowed, and then the reporter rowed, and then the sailor rowed again. They rowed and rowed through the long night. The land had disappeared, but they could hear the low sound of the waves hitting the shore. This was surely a quiet night. The cook finally spoke. "Billy, what kind of pie do you like best?" "Pie," said the sailor and the reporter angrily. "Don't talk about those things." "Well," said the cook, "I was just thinking about ham sandwiches and..." A night on the sea in an open boat is a long night. The sailor continued to row until his head fell forward and sleep overpowered him. Then he asked the reporter to row for a while. They exchanged places so the sailor could sleep in the bottom of the boat with the cook and the captain. The reporter thought that he was the one man afloat on all the oceans in the world. The wind had a sad voice as it came over the waves. Suddenly there was a long, loud, swishing sound behind the boat and a shining trail of silvery blue. It might have been made by a huge knife. Then there was another swish and another long flash of bluish light, this time alongside the boat. The reporter saw a huge fin speed like a shadow through the water, leaving a long glowing trail. The thing kept swimming near the boat. He noted its speed and power. The reporter wished the man would wake up. He did not want to be alone with the shark. The reporter thought as he rowed. He was angry that they had come so close to land and yet might still die at sea. Then he remembered a poem that he had learned as a child. It was a poem about a soldier of the French Foreign Legion. The soldier lay dying in Algiers. Just before he died, he cried out, "I shall never see my own, my native land." And now, many years after he had learned this poem, the reporter, for the first time, understood the sadness of the dying soldier. Hours passed. The reporter asked the sailor to take the oars so that he could rest. It seemed like only a brief period, but it was more than an hour later when the sailor returned the oars to the reporter. They both knew that only they could keep the boat from sinking, and so they rowed, hour after hour, through the night. When day came, the four men saw land again. But there were no people on the shore. A conference was held on the boat. "Well," said the captain, "if no help is coming, we might better try to reach the shore right away. If we stay out here much longer, we will be too weak to do anything for ourselves at all." The others agreed. They began to turn the boat toward the beach. The captain told them to be careful, that when the boat came near the beach, the waves would sink it. Then everyone should jump out of the boat and swim to the shore. As the boat came closer to land, the waves got bigger and more violent. At last, a large wave climbed into the air and fell on the small boat with great force. The boat turned over as the men jumped into the sea. The water was like ice. The reporter was tired, but he swam toward the beach. He looked for his friends. He saw Billy the sailor in front of him, swimming strongly and quickly. The cook was near him. Behind, the captain held on to the overturned boat with his one good hand. Soon the reporter could swim no longer. A current was carrying him back out to sea. He thought, "Am I going to drown? Can it be possible?" But the current suddenly changed, and he was able to swim toward the shore. The captain called to him to swim to the boat and hold on. The reporter started to swim toward the boat. Then he saw a man running along the shore. He was quickly taking off his shoes and clothes. As the reporter got close to the boat, a large wave hit him and threw him into the air over the boat and far from it. When he tried to get up, he found that the water was not over his head, only halfway up his body, but he was so tired that he could not stand up. Each wave threw him down, and the current kept pulling him back to sea. Then he saw the man again jumping into the water. The man pulled the cook to the shore. Then he ran back into the water for the captain. But the captain waved him away and sent him to the reporter. The man seized the reporter's hand and pulled him to the beach. Then the man pointed to the water and cried, "What's that?" In the shallow water, face down, lay Billy the sailor. The reporter did not know all that happened after that. He fell on the sand as if dropped from a housetop. It seems that immediately the beach was filled with men with blankets, clothes, and whiskey. Women brought hot coffee, welcomed the men from the sea to the land. But a still and dripping shape was carried slowly up the beach. And the land's welcome for the sailor's body could only be its final resting place. When night came, the white waves moved in the moonlight. The wind brought the sound of the great sea's voice to the men on the shore.
The Open Boat was written by Stephen Crane. This program was adapted for Special English by Shelley Gollist and produced by Lawan Davis. Your storyteller was Shep O'Neill. You can read and listen to other American stories on our website, voaspecialenglish.com. I'm Barbara Klein.